Let us introduce ourselves. I'm Dial Olopade. I am a journalist, a night law and media scholar at the law school, and a former resident of Nairobi, where I'm speaking with.
I am Wycliffe Muga, living in Nairobi, the weekend editor of the Star newspaper, which is published in Nairobi. And I also work part-time for the BBC World Service. I'm a commentator for a business program, Business Daily.
Which I should add is one of the best programs and best papers. We are here to talk about the Kenyan elections and maybe about Kenyan democracy more generally. The scene, to set it a bit, is that Kenya will vote on Monday, March 4th. It's been 50 years since independence. The last vote was in 2007. It was punctuated by a really unprecedented 3 weeks of really shocking violence. And having lived in Kenya for a little bit, I have to say I'm worried. I feel like, I don't know, you describe the situation in Nairobi as tense. Why is it tense?
It is tense now. Just forgive me. Lights had briefly gone off. They've gone on again. Will that affect the quality of recording?
Probably not the recording, but that's funny to me. KPLC is the Kenya Power and Lighting Company, and yes. Needless to say, it is intermittently functioning. So I'm not surprised.
Yes.
But there's other tension.
It went dark, then it went light again. But these are the issues, actually, which we are hoping a future government might solve. Mm-hmm. There's no excuse for not having a stable, steady power supply. And, of course, you're not going to have a reserve power supply in your own home. If the lights go off, they go off.
That's right.
Anyway, they are on now. The editors will have to decide what they want to remove or leave.
No, I think actually that's helpful. I think that really sort of punctuates the state here. And as a Nigerian, okay. I must say that I found that the light in Kenya was much, much more constant than the light in Lagos, for example, or anywhere outside of that. So, but we hope this is one of the main issues the candidates will address. How do you feel the campaign has gone so far? I guess we can get to the tensions, but I should say that I'm glad that Kenya has had such a robust conversation. I must say there have been two presidential debates. It sounds like everyone on the street is having these conversations by the roadside, on the phone with their neighbors, and there's a real political culture. I think that's good for democracy. What would you say?
I'm afraid I have to disagree with you on that. My experience is Kenyans talk issues, discuss issues, but always vote tribe. Mm. Doesn't matter what they say, this guy did well in the interview, that lady really impressed me. When they get into the secrecy of the voting booth, they'll always vote either for the candidate who's from the same tribe as they are, or for the candidate who is affiliated to the top people, the top political leaders from their tribal community or their ethnic community, as we say these days. So don't let the civil nature of the debates fool you.
Yeah.
The fact is many people had made up their minds beforehand, and you can usually tell how a Kenyan election will play out just by asking who is working with whom, which communities leader has joined into a political pact with whom, what promises have been made, are those promises believable? That's how we vote, I'm afraid.
Now, this is what's interesting to me, right? And I'm aware of this phenomenon. It's not the only African election I followed or covered. And I think it's unusual it's unusual to a certain degree in Kenya, the extent to which the election is so determined by tribe. And I think there's been a lot of interesting writing about it. I read a great piece that's been making the rounds about, you know, we are all tribal, and it's this sort of, it's a sort of fatalistic acceptance of this, just this is the way our politics work. And it's not to say it's any different than maybe the way people feel like they're Democrats or Republicans in the U.S. I think the problem in Kenya, if we could call it a problem, is that no one has a majority. Everyone's got a small piece of the pie. And so you do see these coalitions overlapping. In this election, for example, you have, you know, William Ruto, who is from a Kalenjin tribe, and you have Uhuru Kenyatta, who's a Kikuyu, who were the factions who clashed, you know, most severely in central parts of Kenya last election, are now running on the same ticket, right? And so because tribe both matters and doesn't matter, and that you can just, you know, you'll go with these different alliances sort of shift, you have one totally issue-free politics, right? And two, you know, this sort of heightened potential for violence, because it's not just the issue that people are worried about. It's, you know, something deeper. It's their identity that they're fighting over. And I think that's the sort of danger. And it's really unusual, I would say, even in different countries in Africa whose politics I follow.
It may be unusual, but even for Kenya, what happened in 2008, bearing in mind it was our fourth multi-party elections, it was unusual. And the key to understanding it is remember that there was a widespread, well, 50%, maybe more than 50% of the country felt that there was some illegitimacy in President Kibaki being sworn in. Mm-hmm. The violence was sparked by his being sworn in, and it was felt he had not won and he had no business being sworn in, and that since the courts were heavily compromised back then, there was no point going to court. Mm-hmm. That's not the case now, and that was not necessarily the case before. Mm-hmm. So it's true we vote tribal, but we usually don't fight each other. We just cast our votes, and that's that. But I'll tell you something else, Dale. One other thing. You're saying it's unfortunate. It's not. If we had one tribe which had anything close to 50%, they would dominate Kenyan politics forever and create a possibly more explosive situation. For example, I was reading just the other day that President Kagame is saying he will not run for a third term.
This is in Rwanda.
In Rwanda, forgive me. Yes, in Rwanda. Now, if he did not run, the question is, in a free and fair, transparent election, if there was such an election in Rwanda, chances are someone from the Hutu tribe, the Hutu community would win. Because they are something like, I believe, 65-70%, yes. And they'd always win. So that's a country where the democracy of numbers doesn't quite work. Because among these Hutus would be some of the Interahamwe coming back from the DRC, Congo, and so on. So I don't know how Kagame is going to handle it, but in Kenya we are grateful the largest tribe is just shy of 30%.
Right.
So they need
So it actually works like, it's not like multi-party. I mean, it's almost like it's a parliamentary system where instead of Social Democrats or the Party of the Right, you have Kikuyu, Kalenjin, you have Maasai, you have Luhya, you have Luo. Right, and instead of being parties, they're tribes. I mean, that's one way of thinking about it. I would love to talk more about Rwanda, because I think, you know, it's difficult to process the way that Rwanda 1994 worked, but it was the sort of extreme version of what you saw in Kenya in 2007. And if you'll allow me to make this rough analogy, I think what was difficult about atrocious about Rwanda 1994 was that there were these deeply rooted binary imposed ethnic categories, right, where you were Hutu or Tutsi, and you, it was a matter of identity in the same way that people might feel about tribe in Kenya, just to use the example. And inflaming those tensions, you know, over the course of, you know, years and years, and multiple sort of smaller ethnic moments of ethnic violence, you had built up this kind of reservoir of antagonism. And the downing of the Habyarimana plane was just the thing that triggered, you know, the kindled this huge fire. But, you know, it was for lack of almost transparency, right? It was a monopolistic culture, right, where people, you know, felt swept up in the sense that, you know, we need to kill. Everyone is complicit. Everyone is involved. And I think maybe you can tell me a little bit more about what it was like in 2007 for you, in 2008, in the last election. But there was a sense from the folks that I've spoken to that a similar kind of encompassing logic was going on, right? It was like, they're going to get us, we need to get them. And it was this sort of tribally motivated, totalitarian sense that, you know, this is an existential threat. We need to fight, kill or be killed. And I think what I think is more hopeful about the sort of Kenyan 2007-2008 example is not just, I mean, 1,200 people died. It was clearly a really shocking moment, and it was nothing near the scale of what happened in Rwanda in 1994. But you did have a check on the kind of the one-sided sort of public conversation, right? People, you know, almost within 3 or 4 weeks started to sort of respond in a way that wasn't possible for the 100 days in Rwanda. right? And you had organizations like Ushahidi pop up that were sort of citizen-driven monitoring and sort of violence-containing and monitoring projects that were able to sort of... And I think this is what's more hopeful, even looking at Kenya today, you have now, you know, a very... I mean, you're a journalist there. You know that it's you know, people are able to sort of voice their opinions. It's not a closed society in the same way that Rwanda is. There's a multiplicity of opinions. Even if it's tribal, it's what's the word for it? I mean, there's a kind of democracy on a sort of very basic level to the public discourse that wasn't present in Rwanda, and I think exacerbated what they experienced. And what I do not see in Kenya today that makes me hopeful that, you know, despite disagreeing opinions and different deeply held feelings, there will be a sort of more civil, more democratic outcome. What do you think?
Oh, okay, I'll start with the Ushahidi. Mm. I'm afraid its significance was largely in the eyes of outsiders. Mm. In Kenya, during those difficult days, nobody knew about Ushahidi. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about 90-95% of the population. Mm-hmm. Didn't know about it. Primarily because they do not have access to the internet. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the information about Ushahidi was internet-based, if mm-hmm. I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. So, by and large, what guaranteed that eventually it would not go the way of Rwanda is that to be a Kenyan president, you have to be reasonably rich. You know, you need to be able to hire helicopters and have all sorts of limousines mm-hmm. or SUVs driving through the countryside, etc. So we essentially had one group of rich men against another group of rich men. And these are all people heavily invested in the country. They own hotels, they own residential properties, mm-hmm. they own office
factories.
Now, those are people who have no vested interest in seeing the country go down the tubes, mm-hmm. and so they will compromise. Mm-hmm. And remember, our army stayed in the barracks from the beginning to the mm-hmm. end. Mm-hmm. So it's very different from Rwanda, where the army was complicit, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. there was a, what you call a totalitarian sort of attitude, let's wipe all these guys mm-hmm. out. In Kenya, it may have seemed from the outside as though we're trying to wipe each other out, but the reality is a lot more people would have died if that had been the attitude. Yeah. By and large, it was groups of innocent farmers or innocent slum-dwelling Kenyans, poor Kenyans, who are being attacked by militias, mm-hmm. you know, organized militias mostly with machetes. Fortunately, not
to the extent that there was organization, though, that does seem to replicate the plan for Rwanda in 94, or really 1991 through 1994.
No, I have to disagree. The Rwanda event, as far as I'm aware, was planned years in advance, mm-hmm. and they inculcated. I remember there was one journalist I read about, I forget his name now, I'll remember it in a minute. He wrote articles as far back as he was eventually imprisoned. Mm. But his articles were written 3 or 4 years before the genocide began.
I just mean all to make a narrow point, that to the extent that you had the Mungiki, which is a sort of, you know, gang, for lack of a better word, organized in it. It wasn't an ad hoc kind of, well, let's all, I mean, people were being given pangas in one hand and a piece of bread in the other. To the extent that there was some organization, I just mean to make the point that there's a reasonable comparison, that it wasn't just out of nowhere, that there was planning.
Yes, but here's the thing, Dale. The Mugiki were mostly based in Central Province, and for years they had terrorized the people of Central Province. They were Kikuyus who were killing Kikuyus. So when the time came when the Kikuyus felt, whoever may have been behind the organization, mm-hmm. when they felt that too many of their people had been killed in the Rift Valley, they needed to retaliate, they turned to an existing criminal mm-hmm. gang and mm-hmm. paid them mm-hmm. to go and mm-hmm. fight. Mm-hmm. That's very different from what I understand happened
yes,
in Rwanda.
That's right.
Where ordinary people were killing other ordinary people, killing their neighbors, etc., mm-hmm. etc. So mm-hmm. our militias were existing paid gangs. It's like using a street gang to go and kill your enemies, or using the mafia to mm-hmm. go and kill your enemies.
Right.
That's very different from ordinary people. I'm trying to say that that's why it was relatively easier mm. to stop what mm-hmm. happened in Kenya. Because mm-hmm. it was, I'm not saying it was spontaneous. A lot of the violence seems to have been planned. Mm-hmm. But to get a situation where hundreds of thousands of people are killed using crude weapons.
Mm.
I think that involves the participation of almost the entire, an entire tribe or a large part of the population.
You're correct.
But relatively few Kenyans had blood on their hands after
2008. That's right.
It was mostly the street gangs who were hired to go and attack people from another community.
Right. So
I think that's the fine distinction.
Right. So I read a piece you wrote that I thought was very accurate, given some of my experience in Kenya, which is that, the middle class, which, if we're to step back for a minute, is a significant sort of player and variable across Africa, the sort of rising middle class with, increased income, better education, more engagement. I'm quoting from you. They realized that the country actually had a very large population of very poor people who felt they had nothing to lose. Now, I think that's a very accurate statement, and I'll ask you about it, I guess, in the context of, how much will the middle class... You talked about the resolution coming from the elite who realized that tourism was going to go down and they weren't going to be able to, sell their flats in Kiambu or whatever. But what role will the middle class play as a sort of mediating variable in this round of elections? Since 2007, you might say that there's more or less... influence and consciousness, but what will the memory of that have to play in this particular election?
Okay, I'd say it's not so much the middle class as a group as the sort of institutions which employ people who you would call middle class.
Mm-hmm.
I mean civil society, I mean the judiciary, I mean the media, and organizations like those.
Oh.
The media plays a very big role in determining what sort of news gets to people. And with the example of that gentleman, I've just remembered his name, Hassan Ngeze.
Mm.
That's the Rwandese whose articles 3 years before the genocide, all the same got him in prison because it was so clear that it's by writing such things. They compared him to a Nazi gentleman called Julius Streicher, who had written things which prepared the Germans for the annihilation of the Jews.
Right.
So in the same way, he had prepared the Hutus to kill Tutsis at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, no media house or no editor or no journalist is going to carelessly repeat what a politician says or give it voice through his paper or through his radio station. We may hear people saying really provocative things, but we will not report them. So the public doesn't get so inflamed because they are not hearing some of the terrible things which some people are saying against their tribe and so on. That's one part. Then, of course, civil society. We have a very active civil society. The non-governmental organizations, some funded locally, some funded from overseas sources, they'll take you to court in a minute. If, for example, I said something on this recording which was totally inflammatory to a Kenyan listener, may mean nothing to an American listener, but would inflame a Kenyan listener, someone would have me in court on Monday or Tuesday and say, we found this online, and this gentleman and this lady were talking about this, and the way they did it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that violates, to the extent it was recorded while he was on Kenyan soil, it violates our laws.
Mm.
So that's a check against the excesses of populist politicians.
Mm-hmm.
This is a sad thing because Kenya is still a very poor country,
mm-hmm.
with all our pretensions to
mm-hmm.
approaching middle
mm-hmm.
income and so on. Everyone has less than they expect, and nothing is easier than to tell your own tribal community that another tribe has benefited at their expense.
Yes.
That whatever money there is, it's the other guys who are getting it. That's why you're poor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a message which is very welcome to the poor. But if you say it in a way which constitutes hate speech, then there are all sorts of civil society organizations who are just waiting for that,
mm-hmm.
and they land you in the court. And we do have, for the first time, an independent
mm-hmm.
judiciary, which
mm-hmm.
was vetted the same way they vet the Supreme Court judges in the U.S. and so on. So they are independent. In the past, judges owed the president their appointment. They did
right.
do what the president told them.
Right.
That's not the case anymore. So it's the middle class staffed institutions
yes.
which have the power, not... Because otherwise, the middle class in itself, there's all sorts of exaggerated accounts of how big the Kenyan middle class
mm-hmm.
is. I think it's really very much smaller than most people
claim. I think that's actually really accurate. I think that comment just narrowly really does apply across the continent, right? There's a sense that, we have all of these, people are driving cars and people have cell phones. That doesn't mean, that that all boats are rising. I think that's a fair point. More generally, though, I mean, I agree with you that institutions work. I think that the passing of a new constitution in 2010 was in part, if not totally, a response to the sense that 2007, 2008, you know, went poorly. And that there was a need for devolution, which is to say more power concentrated or less power concentrated in the central government and among members of parliament, and more power concentrated, you know, in local communities with governors and at the county level. I think all of that really does matter. And I think a more, maybe we're spreading opportunities for graft, but maybe there is a real, you know, ability to sort of leverage local institutions and local capacity for Kenya's benefit. That said, I have to feel that the expectations of the voter are what's being manipulated, or what is most likely to lead to a sort of potential violence, right? Like, because maybe there's no Nate Silver or you know, really accurate polling. And I saw this one in Nigeria for our elections in 2011. It is the expectations of the voters that can be manipulated for evil ends. Right. If you expect that your person is going to win, if you expect Uhuru Kenyatta to win because, you know, everyone you know is voting for Uhuru Kenyatta, or everyone you know is voting for Raila Odinga, when the moment comes where that person is not elected, when your expectations have been mismanaged, that, you know, sort of produces the kind of feeling that might potentially lead to violence. And in Nigeria, you know, we had a vote. Buhari was a candidate who people thought might win, but it was really his constituency that was convinced he had been robbed that led to tiny outbreaks of violence in the weeks after the election. So I guess I wonder, you know, to what extent, and this is something that institutions cannot solve. It's something that the judiciary can't solve. And it's up to the politicians to have a sort of, maybe some sense of duty to manage the expectations of the community. So in the event that the vote is close, it's likely to go to a second round, I think you and I would both agree, what responsibility or what actions could the politicians themselves take to manage the expectations of the populace and make sure that there isn't this potential for violence?
Okay, the power has just gone off again, so I'm in the dark. Oh, it's come on again. Would you
KPLC okay. Always wins.
Yes, it did. Okay. Okay, but you're absolutely right in that. It's up to the politicians to manage expectations because institutions can't do that. But there is one other factor. Mm. We actually have fairly accurate polling. We have the three leading polling organizations. That's Ipsos, Synovate, Infotrack, and I forget briefly the name of the third one. They have, between them, accurately, going back to the 2002 elections, they call that accurately. The 2005 referendum, they called that accurately. The 2007, they indicated it was effectively a statistical tie, which is exactly what happened. Of course, we'll never know who really won because there was so much rigging, so much mismanagement. Mm-hmm. But they have never been wrong. Certainly, when you have three independent competing polling organizations mm-hmm. coming up with roughly the same within the plus or minus 5% error, degree of error. When you find them getting the same thing, you have to say they're probably correct. But politicians then tell their supporters, ignore those polls. Those guys don't know what they're doing, or they've been bribed to work against us. So even where you have accurate polling, it changes nothing because no politician is going to tell his supporters, well, we have as good as lost. We might as well give up. Of course not. So he'll keep
going. So that's just a feature of politics. And I think actually, I mean, having covered U.S. elections as well, what was going on with Mitt Romney, you know, at the end of the 2012 campaign really speaks to that, right? I mean, they thought they were going to win up until election day. So maybe it's too much to hope for that the candidates themselves would do that kind of check.
Yes, but also there's something else which is not in the U.S. Politicians may misbelieve polls in the U.S. as here. Mm. But Kenya has a tradition of election rigging to a greater or lesser extent. Mm-hmm. So if Mitt Romney had said, I've been rigged out, nobody would have believed him. Mm-hmm. But in Kenya, when you say, even if you've been beaten by very few,
it's plausible.
But I've been rigged out, It's plausible. Because it's not just the two leading candidates. There are people who are getting 1% in the poll. People like Peter Kenneth and Martha Karua, 2%. Exactly. Yes, and they still tell their supporters the same thing. Don't believe those polls. Mm-hmm. We are winning this thing.
So, and I also think, so what happened in 2007 was, and just for the purposes of those listening, Mwai Kibaki was elected president in 2002 and reelected in 2007. But I'm telling you, I've never seen an African leader miss the opportunity to have a big inauguration party. It's like Museveni, yes. Jonathan, Ellen Sirleaf, they love having these ridiculous parties. Mugabe will fly in. There's a big, everyone pays. And the fact that Mwai Kibaki was sworn in under cover of darkness at the end of 2007 is proof, as far as I'm concerned, that there was something funny going on. African leaders
allow me to disagree with you on that. I don't know if you know this, but it has since come out. The reason why he moved so quickly... even the judiciary was divided. And apparently, according to our old constitution, any high court judge can swear in a president. So there were judges who had said, we are willing to go and swear in Raila Odinga right now. So Kibaki moved quickly to be sworn in, because if he had not, Raila would have been sworn in before
him.
Even greater chaos.
That really underscores the extent of the judiciary in Kenya was... not independent, for lack of a stronger term.
Not
at the minimum. That were, able to be bought and sold, and that they're, you could never imagine that happening in the United States.
That's exactly.
And
what
I think Willie Mutunga is the new Chief Justice, who is, I think, a credible figure that a lot of people respect. And so that is, at least in Kenya's defense, a real change since the last time.
Let me interrupt you and say, the last time we had someone the whole country believed in, it was Samuel Kivuitu, who died just 2 or 3 days ago of cancer, but he was a former chairman of the Electoral Commission of Kenya. And the country loved this man, the country believed in this man. He mismanaged the 2007 general election. And so I will say Mutunga seems credible, Mutunga seems impressive. I personally believe he has no interest before him other than to serve the nation well. But I will believe it
when you see
after I've seen a little evidence. Because we've believed
trust
before and
verify,
been let down
trust
before.
But verify.
Yes, yes. Yes.
All right, so we have to talk about, since we're talking about judicial institutions, we have got to talk about the ICC. My favorite part of the first presidential debate, and I should parenthetically give Kenya so much credit for the extent to which the sight of 8 candidates awkwardly standing behind podiums. We've seen it a million times in the U.S., but it is really novel in Kenya. So there were 2 presidential debates, among which my favorite moments were the ability for, the interrogators who are your colleagues in the media in Kenya to really ask tough questions of the candidates. My favorite segment was when they asked about the ICC. They were like, this is the elephant in the room. The International Criminal Court has indictments for one of the presidential candidates and his running mate. This is Uhuru Kenyatta and William Ruto, directly as a result of the election violence that we've been discussing today in 2007, 2008. And no one seems to want to talk about it. Isn't that a problem? And the candidates sort of all squirmed and made some general statements that they had prepared, and when pressed, kind of ducked and evaded. And there was a lot of my brother this, my sister that. What do you think? Do people talk about this elephant in the room, which is the potential for, a president to be elected who is also a convicted war criminal?
Okay, he's not convicted yet, and I'm told the way that the ICC works, it could easily be 2 or 3 years before a decision was reached. But he is indicted. And that is bad enough, because it means enough evidence has been found to take him to a full trial. That already one level of evidence has been found sufficient. Now it only remains to see if there will be enough evidence to convict him. So it's something people talk about. It's something many of us have written about. And this is where the problem is. I told you Kenyans vote tribe. If they voted issues, Uhuru's own friends, Uhuru's own supporters would say, we believe you deserve to be president of Kenya. We think you'd make a great president of Kenya. But why don't you take a few years off, take care of this. Go and defend yourself. Give your full attention to the ICC. We believe you're innocent. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, I'm sure his supporters believe he's totally mm-hmm. innocent. Mind you, a strange thing is, on the one hand, they say he's innocent, he didn't do anything. The same people will say, then you say, why is he so popular? Oh, because he is the one who defended us when we might all have been killed. Then you say, uh-huh. then how exactly did he defend yes. you? Okay? Because if you say he's popular because he defended his tribe, then you're that's saying he's the one who sent the Mungiki into the Rift Valley mm-hmm. to kill people. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's very tricky for them. But the point is, since he is so popular and no one will say anything to him, the other candidates know that even if you pin him down, I mean, there's no Kenyan who doesn't know that he's indicted in the ICC. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter what you say to him, it will not change a single vote one way or the other. So it's on par with, let's imagine, you know, you've heard people saying, oh, George Bush should have been indicted by the ICC mm-hmm. if only America belonged to the ICC.
The statute, right.
Yes, exactly. Or Tony Blair. Now, in their countries, nobody talks about it. No mm-hmm. one's they live freely. So it's something very similar. They're essentially saying he didn't kill anyone. There's no blood on his hands. They are saying he was at the head of an organization. No one has proved yet the organization exists. And above all, they say, surely he is innocent until proven guilty. So why should we treat him as guilty right now and deny him a chance to run for president and ask him to shelve his ambitions when there is no proof that he is guilty? Let him run if he wants to.
Yeah, so, right. I mean, I hear you. I understand the argument. I think it's easy to understand why Uhuru Kenyatta is running for president, right? I mean, this is his safe harbor for the worst case scenario. I think it's less easy to understand why people are still...
No, let me correct you on that. I know it's widely believed that he believes that if Bashir had not been president of Sudan, the president of Sudan, whoever that was, would have handed him over long ago. He'd have been in the holding cells of the ICC, etc. So that the safest thing for an African politician, mm-hmm. if the ICC is after you,
is to become
is
president.
President.
Now, I should also say, Bashir
I don't think
came,
it's that simple.
Bashir
I don't think
came
it's that simple
to Kenya,
at all.
And Kenya Sorry? Didn't extradite him. Bashir came to Kenya.
Yes.
And Kenya, which is a party to the Rome Statute, did not extradite him. I thought that that was yes. emblematic of what I would call a defiance of the ICC that is paired with a sense of persecution from the ICC, that the ICC picks on African leaders as opposed to Tony Blair and George Bush or anyone else you could think of outside of maybe the former Yugoslavia. And so there's, I think, rhetorically, Uhuru Kenyatta has been very successful in sort of leveraging this indictment into a sense of sort of external interference and a neo-imperialism that may or may not exist. And I think the ICC, and particularly Luis Moreno Ocampo, the prosecutor, has handled the whole situation very badly. But it's very easy for Uhuru Kenyatta to say, it's a defense to become president. We'll agree. Because, you know, there is... a sense of illegitimacy that comes along with the ICC, that's very easy to make that case as well.
I'm afraid you're completely wrong on that.
Why?
In Kenya, we are just tribal. If you talk to anyone outside Uhuru's own tribe, they'll say exactly that if it was not for the ICC intimidating Kenyan leaders by taking six top people, well, five top people and one journalist, there goes the lights mm-hmm. again. If it was not for the ICC, we would certainly have had an expectation of violence this time around. And that is the knowledge.
I disagree with you. When you saw...
I know we disagree. I told you at the beginning that I disagree with you. So obviously you disagree with me too. I'm just telling you what I hear, what I see. And I've discussed these things with many, many other journalists. Mm-hmm. And our belief is that only the Kikuyu are say, and the Kalenjin are saying the ICC should stay away from our affairs. Everyone else
all,
is very happy to have
of,
the ICC.
All six of the leading candidates at that first debate, when asked about this, made a specific point. I'm talking about the political salience of talking about the ICC as interventionist. All of the candidates, Martha Kurua, Peter Kenneth, Mwite, as well as Raila Odinga, who has every reason to want Uhuru Kenyatta at The Hague, all of them said, we voted to make sure there was a local tribunal. We wanted to do this in Arusha. We don't believe that there's a real political value to running against the ICC. And I think all the candidates demonstrated that. Whether or not they believe it is another thing. But it has been useful beyond Uhuru Kenyatta and William Ruto to talk against the ICC, whether it's to pretend that they're not, you know, stepping on the neck of their brother or whatever they're calling Kenyatta these days. There is a strategic usefulness in running against the ICC that I think is dangerous for the court's legitimacy going forward, frankly.
It's not dangerous. And Kenyan campaigns are all drama, they're all theater. Right. No one who understands the issues takes what those presidential candidates say seriously.
Right, but they all said it.
An American president making wild promises about what he'll do about taxes and mm-hmm, so forth. And mm-hmm. everyone who understands the issues knows that he'll be limited by Congress, limited by the mood of the country, he'll be limited by a dozen other things. In fact, the way I'd say it is, yes, abortion is a pretty tricky matter in the U.S. Mm-hmm. There are candidates who, I believe, or from what I've read, would very willingly want to say, if a woman wants to have an abortion, let her have it. But they know that their constituents will straight away jump on them. It will be used against them. Mm-hmm. Now, the communities which all of the ICC indictees come from are the biggest voting communities. So mm-hmm. you will antagonize them if you say anything exactly. along the lines of they right. should be there. But right. that doesn't mean they believe it. And
of
doesn't
course.
Mean that
no,
the ICC
I think we
has
can
no
agree
legitimacy.
There. I think we can agree mm-hmm. there. That they're saying, I mean, that they're all talking out of the side of their mouth and they don't really mean it. And actually, when it came yes. up for a vote in Parliament, they couldn't get a quorum. So they didn't actually vote. But they all said they would yes. have supported, you know, doing this locally. But the thing is, yes. you know, Ocampo came in because it took after 4 years, there had been no action locally because it may be fair to say Uhuru Kenyatta, the son of the first president of Kenya, can't get a fair trial. I mean, it would be impossible politically to try Uhuru Kenyatta in Kenya, especially given the state of the judicial institutions at the time. I think that's fair, yes. which is why the ICC is a court of last resort. I understand it. What I'm upset yes. about, maybe you'll agree with me here, is that the prosecutor, Ocampo, has not given the Kenyan people the enjoyment of certainty. This trial is ongoing. The indictment has come down far too late. Maybe you could say they were just waiting for Kenya to act. But the point is, wouldn't this election be easier if we had certainty about the outcome of the trial? And to that extent,
my
the
understanding,
ICC is
Dayo, is that the way the ICC proceeds, they don't care whether they have an election or not. Otherwise, it would be very easy to frustrate their work if each time there's an election, they have
right.
to stop. They are proceeding on their own timetable. Unfortunately, that coincides with the Kenyan election. And
it's
I don't know if you heard the
latest,
but of course the elections have been, the,
yeah, the trial
hearings are probably going to be in August, yes. Mm-hmm. So now there will be no clash. Mm. Long before he has to go to the ICC,
it will be decided.
Uhuru Kenyatta will know whether he's president or he's not president.
I have to
but
say,
one thing
it's
I
the
to
wrong
tell you.
Order. It's really upsetting. I mean, I think Odinga got
to be upset
off
about.
One of the...
I'm Kenyan, I'm here. I'm not the least upset. Mm. I think Ocampo did a great job.
Really? Wow. All right. Well, we'll disagree about that. I think... Insofar as certainty is useful for geopolitics...
But is there
any
judicial process which gives certainty? I've never heard of such a thing.
You're right. The idea is to do justice. The idea is to do justice. But it can't be overlooked that the timing is very unfortunate insofar as... I mean, maybe we should talk then about what are the scenarios, right? Kenyatta is convicted... and he wins the election. Kenyatta is convicted and he doesn't win the election. Kenyatta is acquitted and he wins. I mean, there's a diagram here. What are the outcomes? What are the consequences of this? And I guess I would ask you in terms of locally in Kenya, maybe it doesn't matter. Nobody cares. The president, you know, doesn't feed you. The president doesn't send your kids to school. The president doesn't pay
you.
Oh,
yes, he does. Oh, yes, he does.
Or, and domestically, I want to hear about the consequences in these scenarios. And also internationally. I mean, there's all this talk that, oh, you know, the West will shun Kenya. Kenya will be a pariah state. Do you believe any of that? What are the practical consequences of these such scenarios?
Okay, I believe a lot of that because I can't imagine. As soon as Kibaki was elected, the first thing that George W. Bush did is that was in 2002. He invited him to the White House with all his advisors, sat him down, talked to him. This I know from a former U.S. ambassador who was present. And said, you have a great chance to turn Kenya around and with it all of East Africa. Mm-hmm. Just clamp down on corruption, have proper governance, and we will support you every step of the way. Okay? Now, whether President Kibaki did that or didn't do that is a different matter. But mm-hmm. that's what was said. Mm-hmm. There is no way Uhuru gets elected and is invited to Windsor Castle, wherever it is in the UK, they invite, or to the White House, and told, okay, you're the new president, we'll do business with you. They'll avoid him like a leper. Well, that's not a very politically correct thing to say, but they'll avoid him, because until such times as the ICC finds him innocent, the mere fact that he's been indicted suggests there's a certain level of evidence objectively obtained suggesting he had a hand in mass murder and killing of the people of the
country. And I should also say that having a trial before he stands for election has the benefit of airing what evidence there is. And this is, again, part of my critique of Ocampo and his handling of it. Because to see the evidence and the witnesses before voting...
Did you say you're studying law?
Correct.
Does the legal procedure ever take any notice at all of whether there's an election?
Of course not. But I just mean to say, and I didn't mean to interrupt you because I think this is an important point you're making. The point is that the case against Kenyatta or for him hasn't been aired for the Kenyan people. And maybe this is a failure of journalism. Maybe this is a feature of an issue-free political system that we've been talking about. But the point is that the facts are not all exposed. And because...
They are all exposed, Dayo. The thing is, let me take you back to the president before Kibaki, that was Daniel Arap Moi. During his time in office, there had been political assassinations. There was all sorts of economic mismanagement, massive, massive corruption, all sorts of things. Didn't prevent him winning twice in 1992 and 1997 because he was clever enough to put together a coalition of tribes which would enable him to get victory. And back then, we didn't have the 50+1 rule for winning. One election he won with about 35%, one he won with about 40%, but the rest of the vote was splintered between half a dozen other candidates, and he had the most, by far. So what I'm trying to tell you is that in a situation like this, whether Uhuru gets elected or not has nothing to do with the ICC. It's a matter of which tribes, which tribal communities he has got working with him, and which ones are opposed to him. It's
so you think it's a completely neutral political variable? The trial.
No,
I mean, I'm willing
neutral.
To agree with you because I hear what you're saying and it makes sense to me. It makes sense to me. But you can't then also say that it's not helpful for him to have this. I don't know. I think that it's helped him on some very basic level. And I think I read, I'm not sure who said it. I'll have to look up the article. Maybe we can include it as a link to the dialogue that, you know, he's a very mediocre politician, save the ICC. And he's young. I mean,
that's his opponents making. He's a very good public speaker, both in a conference or in a large, massive public rally. He's very eloquent. What I'm told is he has no real skills in management and so on. But then many politicians don't. He has no discipline of the kind which President Obama is so famous for. But
so let's talk
he wouldn't have got this far if he was an absolute nobody. He's actually a pretty good politician.
His last name is Kenyatta, I would also submit. I mean,
yes.
It's easy. And we can talk about Odinga, who is also a member of a Kenyan political dynasty from the beginning of the country's independence. But I want you to finish your thought about the domestic consequences of a potential Kenyatta presidency with a conviction. Because I know internationally, you know, of course he's not going to be playing basketball with Obama. But what happens internally? Does it matter?
No, I don't think so. If he wins, and there's every chance that he might, by and large, the only thing he has to watch out for is Parliament impeaching him. Because if Odinga has more members of Parliament on his side, and that's possible. In the last election, Odinga had 100 members of Parliament, 110 or so. Kibaki, who allegedly won, had less than that. So if Odinga has more members of Parliament, then the first order of business is to impeach him. Then again, we have an independent judiciary now. With that independent judiciary, someone could take up the matter and say, is the president duly elected, or has there been some funny business in the process of getting him elected? And the judiciary may yet decide, the Supreme Court that is, may yet decide that actually he was not elected in a constitutional manner or something like that. So, of course, he'd then be in court for a long time. But locally, if people come to terms with the fact that Kenyatta has won, then the country goes on in the same way as in 2007.
Well,
the country went on.
The country went on, but the economy tanked. No one can say that. There was upwards of 5% GDP growth in the year leading up to 2007, and it went down to 1.2% the year that followed. Kenya had a slow recovery.
That, I have to concede that point to you. When I said that country real. I didn't mean it goes on pleasant.
I mean, I know exactly what you meant.
But I mean we live
about,
with
let's
it.
Let's talk about the regional consequences, because Kenya is vitally important, and I know you know this, but for the benefit of our people listening to us, you know, there are four landlocked countries that depend on Kenya's ports, right? There are there's violence in the southern coastal area of Somalia that the Kenyan military has invaded with the help of the United States and with the help of Ugandans. And it's not just economically important, it's important for regional security, and it's obviously got as a source of foreign exchange, tourism is an important import or export that Kenya has. So let's talk about everything we're saying sounds complicated. And for an investor or for someone thinking of honeymooning, wouldn't they rather just go to Tanzania or wouldn't they rather just go to South Africa? I mean, that's important. So talk to me about what
you think will happen. Those are two different categories you're talking about. The tourists, of course, won't come. But as I understand it, things like one of the fears is that our three major exports, that is cut flowers and fruits and vegetables, horticulture, coffee, and tea,
and, yeah.
that